Welcome back to The Big Something from KRCC, in-depth conversation on culture and ideas in the Pikes Peak region. I'm Jake Brownell. Kathy Jaffray, professor of sociology at Colorado College, just published her first novel, The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato. It's a coming-of-age story that follows a tomboyish young woman named Josie on a philosophical romp through love and community in a bar called The Cave. The Big Something's Noel Black spoke with her in advance of her book release party earlier this month.
Kathy Jaffray, thank you for joining us to talk about your new novel, The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato, which is being published tomorrow officially.
Right. September 8th is its birthday.
That's exciting.
It is exciting.
It's just a few. It's a Virgo. This book is a Virgo.
So is my son. So that works really well together.
And although, so am I. That's great. To start off, talk about how this novel came about. Have you always... This is your first novel, right?
This is my first novel. It's my fourth book, but my first novel.
So what made you want to write a novel? Have you always wanted to write a novel? And how did this particular book come together?
Well, so, you know, I grew up reading. I grew up in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, where there is not a whole lot to do. And books were really my lifesaver there. Books were my lifeline when I was growing up. So I've always been a huge reader. I've always loved reading. I love the feel of a book in my hands. Because I'm a college professor, writing is one of the things I do a lot. So I write articles. I've written books before, but they're scholarly books sometimes about technical subjects. So one of them is about social network analysis. But actually, I was on sabbatical, and I woke up from a dream one morning with the first line of this book in my head. So I wrote that line down, and then I spent a week actually writing down the first chapter of the book. It seemed to come all by itself. And then I spent 6 years writing the rest of the book very slowly in between all the other things that I had to do.
So the first line is, this was in the days when nighttime used to mean something.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Did everything emerge from that sentence? Or, you know, I have to ask you the gratuitous, is this autobiographical? Does it refer to a period of time in your life? And it's sort of a coming of age story.
It's
a love story.
Yes.
There's a murder in it too, but it doesn't come till a long ways into the book.
Right. Actually, it emerged from, I have to say, everything that I write actually has the same audience, oddly enough, which is my children, because I think that I have a need to document things that I think are going to escape. And this is about a time, there are autobiographical elements in this, very much so. It's set in a bar called The Cave. I used to be a bartender in a bar called The Cave. And this is set there. Some of the characters are based on people I knew then. But it was very much trying to capture a time that I think actually is long gone in the United States, the time when nighttime used to mean something, when we didn't have 24-hour-a-day television, when television went off the air at night.
Right, which you talk about at the beginning.
Right. When stores closed, when finding an open gas station was actually an issue. And I don't think my children know about that world. This world has beautiful things in it. That world had beautiful things in it, too. There were lovely parts of that.
There was a sense that I think that night was much more of an unknown. When it was, there was something kind of frightening about night in an exciting way. And that seems to have been lost in some part with our constant connection to everything. There's much less of a sense that you could actually get lost to the night.
Yeah, and I think that getting lost is a huge part of this. It's scary, but it's also very freeing to think that you may get lost to the night somewhere. That it would be that you would be out of contact with people is something that actually is rather rare today. So when I talk to the students in my class, in my art and society class, the first day I ask them, is there any cultural form you wish didn't exist? And overwhelmingly, they say social media because they feel so enslaved to it. But at the same time, I say, well, why don't you turn it off? And they say they can't.
So
they
social can't. Media is the new cave.
Isn't that we are all trapped down there. But, you know, there are good parts of that, too. At least we have each other down there in that cave.
Right. I texted you on social media today.
I am here because of Facebook right this minute.
Well, let's talk about The Cave, Plato's mm-hmm. allegory of the cave, which mm-hmm. figures heavily, although lots of other Greek mythology figures mm-hmm. heavily in here, too. Well, and Plato's interpretation mm-hmm. of that. How did that trope come to you. It's a charming way of incorporating it, in a lot of ways, because you disagree with it throughout the book.
Right. Well, actually, through the entire first version of this book, I didn't realize that that's what this was. I was trying to figure out, one of the things that was very hard for me to write about was to write about happiness, about how it is when you're happy, when it seems like it's just summer forever and not much is going on. And I think it was easier for me to write about things that were tragic events, whereas happiness tends to be rather uneventful, and so that makes it difficult to write about. So I was trying to think about, how do I express happiness? And I actually, when I get stuck, I find that if I take a bath, the idea comes to me. And so sometimes I take like 3 or 4 baths a day, depending on how troublesome something is that I'm working on. But I was in the bathtub, actually, and it came to me, the Greek myth about Persephone and Demeter, and how that the point of that is that summertime, Demeter causes summertime to happen because she is happy. When her daughter returns to her, she's happy and causes summertime. So that was the first one of these things. And so I started putting in a little Greek mythology every now and then, mostly to help me tell stories, because I think that's one of the things mythology does. It helps us tell stories.
Right. It is interesting, too, that, I mean, we think now that we're happy because it's summer, because it's warm out, but the cause and effect were reversed entirely, which is such a subtle little turn.
Such a subtle thing. So it wasn't actually until the very end of the book, the last thing I wrote was the retelling of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. I felt like such a moron, because at that point I suddenly realized, oh, guess what? This whole book is about Plato. It's set in a place called the Cave that actually did not occur to me until I had written the entire book.
Well, see, and that is to me almost the exact same thing as you saying this, you know, thing about Demeter causing summer because of her happiness, because to me it has the tropeness to it, as though it's sort of scaffolding for the book, that you hung it on this very clever literary thing. And that's fascinating to me that it came afterward, because I would have thought, especially since the bar is called the Cave,
you would have thought I would have recognized that. Yes.
It's great. The subconscious does wonders.
The subconscious does wonders. Yeah. And so that was, you know, when I was growing up, I read tons of Greek mythology. I was really interested in it. So it was there for me. It was there in my head, but I completely did not recognize it the first time through. So this book was written and rewritten several times. And it was only as it went along that structure actually was put into the book.
Another myth that figures heavily in this book is Aristotle's theory of love, of Zeus splitting our souls in twain because humans were threatening the gods, and that we have to go out looking for our other halves. Talk a little bit about the love story in this.
Right. Well, certainly in my life, I spent time finding my other half, and it's been a long time. Actually, I didn't get married until I was 40 years old, because it took me that long to find the one who was for me, who is for me. And so I think also, you know, I spend my days almost all day with people who are between the ages of 18 and 22, college students. And we talk about lots of things. We talk about sociology, and we talk about how their calculus class is going, and we talk about what's going on in their lives, though. And one of the things I discover is this thing, looking for that other half, is something that human beings, in fact, spend an enormous amount of time doing and go through a lot of pain trying to do that. This is not an easy process. Our one true love doesn't fall off trees for most people. And I think that the feeling of finding that other person, especially when you've searched a long time, when you've really searched, is an amazing feeling. It's quite profound.
And so you believe it. You believe in the in one's other half completing.
I do. I have to say I do. And maybe it's because in my life, I got the guy, right? I got the one guy for me. And so I think I was very, very lucky. But I also think, as I said, it was a long search. It was a long search through lots of people who were lovely in many ways, but they weren't the one.
You also put forward this interesting idea. I really love this, that women or people look for bad boys that you know essentially aren't going to work out, because what you're preserving is your freedom until you meet the one who is going to complete you and essentially create a kind of a more enlightened freedom.
Right.
And so one must find the inevitable breakup person.
They're great. You know, so there's this question, right, that a lot of people ask. Why is this nice woman, why is this nice man dating this person who's so bad, who's clearly so bad in every way? It's a question, actually, that a lot of people ask. What is she doing with him? What is he doing with her? I don't understand this. And it took me a long time to realize that I dated my share of people who were bad for me and who just in general were bad in lots of very fun ways. They were bad in lots of very fun ways. But clearly there was no future in any of these relationships. And you think, why didn't I pick this nice person there? And the answer to that, I really think, is I wasn't ready to be in a long-term relationship. So as a matter of fact, the one for me, my husband now, that I married when I was 40, was my college boyfriend. But I broke up with him because I wasn't ready then to be married. I had a lot of wild oats to sow. And I think there's something really fabulous about sowing wild oats. Everyone should sow wild oats. And if you happen to manage to keep yourself free by dating the wrong one a lot, that's, you have to be careful not to marry them. That's a tricky thing. You got to watch out for that. Never, never go to Vegas with the wrong one, because that's just asking for trouble. Yeah. But it does. It's not that we all necessarily are ready to be married and forever when we're 21 years old. Some of us aren't ready for a while. And there's a lot of fun things to do in the meantime. And bad boys are really fun to do those things with.
And Danny is your bad boy in this book. But he's very nice. He's a very nice bad boy.
I love bad boys. They're wonderful. Bad boys, and so are bad girls, really wonderful. As long as you don't make the mistake of thinking that they're ever going to be anything other than the bad boy or the bad girl.
And do you think that they are just the bad boy or the bad girl to you, and to them they're the good one, and there's some other bad boy and some other bad girl? Is it, everyone is essentially both creatures, right?
Right, right. I think that the bad boys, the bad girls, are also looking for the one for them, but they're not ready yet either. And maybe there are people who never will be, and that's cool too.
I would say I know lots of people who, you know, love maybe never really worked out, but they end up, you know, being happy as,
absolutely,
as solo creatures.
Yeah. So the idea that we all have to end up somehow with that other one, or our lives are lesser, I absolutely disagree with. But I think the thing, and part of the thing I wanted to say in the book, is you may not end up with the other one, but there's all sorts of ways of having love. And one of the ways of having love is in a community, right? So this book is very much about a community of people who don't all end up paired up with the perfect other one at the end. It's not a Jane Austen novel where everything clicks into place in the end and everyone's in happy pairs. That doesn't happen. I think what happens in this book is that the community of love is really the place where that support happens. And so that's why, I disagree with Plato. He says, when we make this solo journey from the cave up into this enlightened world above all by ourselves, then that's a very high good. I don't know. It's all right being down in the cave with your pals, talking to each other, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer. It's all right.
Seems Plato, it's sort of it's the birth of the individual and individualism in some way. That idea that you would rise up by yourself and then also simultaneously believe that you had done it all yourself and it was by your own solo sheer will that had happened. We seem to be really fond of that as Americans in particular.
Yeah, that we're all individuals, we're all on our own, and that people who don't do that actually are somehow lesser, we're to pity them. And that's the word Plato uses, actually, is pity, that this person who's come out of the cave will look back at his comrades, his former comrades, with pity. I don't know. I think that we might look back at our former comrades with a sense of nostalgia, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Those were some good days. And I think that a lot of people feel that. Those were good days when it was all of us together and nobody had any money and nobody had a high-pressure job and nobody had anything to lose, and we were just there for each other. And that was something certainly I experienced in my life.
I like this, too, because in a sense, I mean, even though there is definitely a kind of narrative push that is supported by the scaffolding of the mythology. It's very much character study, and it's very much about people relating to one another and slowly peeling back their foibles and their character flaws, but also their characters and what makes them humans, and in this way that is very unusual for a novel. It doesn't, you know, as I said, there's a murder, but the book doesn't hang on it.
No.
And so it's a nice sort of study of community more than just a character study.
Right. And so I think that's, you know, that's what happens when sociologists write novels, is we tend to be very interested in things like community, subculture, how does that work? And certainly I didn't want to make this be, you know, a whole bunch of angels and aren't they all lovely. They're not. Everyone in it is flawed. But I think that especially in American society, we have an idea that to be flawed is somehow a bad thing. But in fact, I think being flawed is a lovely thing when we all recognize that we are all flawed and we can embrace each other's flaws and see that the flaws are actually part of what makes someone wonderful. Then we can create communities that are really loving and supportive instead of saying everyone has to be perfect. Actually, when I started writing this book, I kept a quote from Christopher Isherwood on my desk. Christopher Isherwood wrote the Berlin stories, which is where we get eventually the musical Cabaret, the story of Sally Bowles first appears there. And he said something, I can't remember the exact quote, but he said when he started writing this, which is set in Berlin at the end of the 1920s as Hitler is rising to power, he said, I wanted to write a book about people that society in general considers outcast, to be shunned. And he wanted to write a book with love about those people. And in some ways, the people in this book are very much like that. They're a little bit outcast. They're people who don't fit in, but who've managed to make a community for each other, to make a family for each other.
Could I ask you to read a passage?
Sure. Let me read this, the very first section, which is the first one written and is still one of my favorites.
Okay.
All right. This was in the days when nighttime used to mean something. At midnight, the television stations all played the Star Spangled Banner and then went dark until time for the Farmer's Weather Report at dawn. You couldn't go to the grocery store after 9 p.m. All the other stores closed at 8. It might be hard to find an open gas station. Last call was taken seriously at all the local bars. People had been known to get busted running red lights, trying to make it in time. In Waterville, the only all-night restaurant of any kind was Clyde's Chicken, a brightly lit fried chicken joint that usually had only one thing on the menu, chicken and biscuits. There was sometimes a handwritten sign taped up on the wall announcing the temporary addition of fried livers and gizzards to the menu. I never saw anyone eat them, although I've heard some, such as Stinky, claim to. He felt it gave him an air of distinction. Some men woo women with wine or with roses or with dates to see movies. These men show a lack of imagination. Danny wooed me with a handful of early spring violets and a 2 a.m. trip to Clyde's Chicken. Are you going to eat the gizzards to impress me? I asked. Lord, no, he said, and shuddered.
Kathy Giffray, The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato's fantastic book, a novel, first novel. Totally jealous and also super happy for you. Good job.
Thank
you. It's a great cover, too.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was KRCC's Noel Black speaking with Colorado College professor Kathy Giffray about her new novel, The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato. To hear that interview again and for a link to buy the book, go to krcc.org. This is The Big Something. We'll be right back.